The headlines this hour. Iran says it is following up the cases of its nationals detained in the U.S. who are being held in dreadful conditions and under false pretext. The Italian ambassador to the Democratic Republic of the Congo is killed in an attack on a United Nations convoy. And thousands of Algerians rally in the capital and other cities to mark the second anniversary of the anti-government protest movement that ousted longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran says the fate of Iranian nationals detained in the U.S. has always been a priority for Tehran and that it is following up the cases seriously. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said most of these prisoners are being held in dreadful conditions and under false pretext. He said this cruel policy is a legacy of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The spokesman said the new administration has not still taken any measures in this regard. However, he said the U.S. has sent messages to the Swiss embassy in Tehran, as well as other envoys, to resolve the issue. He said that Iran's proposal of exchanging prisoners with the U.S. is still valid, referring to a 2018 proposal by the Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The Iranian parliament and government are at loggerheads over a deal reached with the International Atomic Energy Agency to monitor activities of the country's nuclear sites. Parliament says the agreement violates a law that calls for ceasing the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but the government says the accord is in line with the legislation. Political commentator Sam Mehdi Torabi believes the rift shows that Iran has a vibrant democracy.
Actually, it's basically the government implementing the law and the legislation that was passed by the Majlis, which is the duty of the executive branch. The executive branch has a certain amount of leeway in which way it wants to implement the law, which is fine. That's part of the normal processes of governance and government. It did it in this way. As we saw, also Majlis had some complaints about the way it was implemented, which is again a normal process of a healthy, vibrant, democratic republic. The Majlis made a decision to send its complaints to the third branch, which is the judiciary branch, in order for these differences to be settled. And so I think actually it was quite a good day in terms of showing to the world that Iran is a place where there's a rule of law. Iran is a place where decisions are made in a rational manner, where the different branches have their separate duties and they do the things they have to do under the Constitution, and there's no such thing as an impasse. If there's issues comes up, there's always a way to resolve them.
The Italian ambassador to the Democratic Republic of the Congo has been killed in an attack on the United Nations convoy. The Italian Foreign Ministry said in a statement that Luca Attanasio was shot dead near the eastern city of Goma while traveling in a car with a convoy of UN organization stabilization mission. An Italian policeman and a driver were also killed. The Italian President Sergio Mattarella has condemned the assault as cowardly. The European Commission also expressed concern over the situation in the African country.
The news are extremely worrying, and we are following the situation closely with the EU delegation in DRC. The HRVP has reported this to the FAC and presents its condolences to Italy, to the UN, and to the victims of the violence in Congo.
No group has yet claimed responsibility for the assault. Local authorities say the attack was part of an attempt to kidnap UN personnel. The UN World Food Program says that a number of people in the convoy were also wounded, but has not given any further details. Dozens of armed groups operate in the area where the incident took place. Max Civilli says that according to local rangers, the attack on the UN convoy in the Democratic Republic of the Congo was an attempted robbery.
Basically, it seems it was an attempted robbery, according to rangers at the local Virunga National Park. As you said before, Luca Attanasio, the Italian diplomat, died in an hospital of gunshot wounds to the abdomen after arriving in a hospital in critical condition, and the carabiniere and the policeman, Iacovacci, was a 30-year-old man from a small town south of Rome, He had been serving at the Italian embassy in the Democratic Republic of Congo since September. And the envoy's car was part of a Monasco UN peacekeeping mission convoy, and it was attacked with light weapons by a terrorist commando. And as you said before, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio voiced immense grief after learning of what happened while he was at an EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels. He said Italy would make every effort to shed light on the incident.
Algerian police have clashed with demonstrators who hit the streets to mark the second anniversary of the country's anti-government protest movement. Thousands of protesters marched across the capital Algiers while police tried to disperse them. Police checkpoints have also created heavy traffic. In February 2019, Algerians embarked on a nationwide protest campaign against the government of former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. 2 months later, the longtime ruler was forced to resign. However, protesters continued their movement, demanding a sweeping overhaul of the ruling system. The rallies were suspended last March due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The European Union has agreed to impose sanctions on 4 Russian officials in response to the jailing of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. 2 EU diplomats who broke the news said no names were discussed as the bloc's 4 ministers agreed on the sanctions. But they said the bans are likely to hit Russia's director of prisons and prosecutor general, among others. This comes after Moscow called on other countries, including the U.S. and the EU nations, to stay out of Navalny's case, calling it an internal issue. Kremlin critic lost an appeal against his 3-year prison conviction this week. He was detained on February 2 for violating a 2014 parole, a charge that he denies. Our correspondent from Brussels, Jerome Hughes, joins us. We also have John Ross, who's a senior fellow at Chongyang Institute, who joins us from London. So, Jerome, Russia has made its case very clear when it comes to Navalny, that it's an internal issue. And yet you have the European Union that has imposed these sanctions on Russian officials. Are the reasons given by the EU purely the Navalny case?
Well, listen, it's an ongoing campaign by the European Union against Russia, and we have the same campaign being run by NATO, and it's well documented, and we've reported on it so many times. And as we heard today from the EU foreign affairs ministers, they're meeting today in Brussels, and this morning as they went into the meeting, each one of them gave statements, and it was full of anti-Russia rhetoric, but mainly in relation to, in this particular case, the Navalny situation. And, you know, it's rarely highlighted or ever, you never hear it highlighted in the Western mainstream media here that, as you mentioned in the introduction, this prison sentence given to Navalny is relation to, breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence. And it's like any country with a judiciary. If you break the terms of a suspended prison sentence, it becomes a prison sentence. But, you know, this is never highlighted. Also, they accused him, they accused Russia of poisoning him last August. And Russia, the Kremlin, has been saying, show us the evidence, show us the lab tests, show us the lab results, show us the medical evidence for this. And we have the situation where the EU countries involved at that case last August, they will not give any evidence to the Kremlin. So it's the same old case, and we've seen a similar situation in the past in that regard as well. And then you have how the Western mainstream media report on the protests. You know, we have the Navalny protests in Russia, and the people involved are portrayed as heroes, and they're looking for justice and so on. And the media here never mention the fact that we're in a global pandemic, and it's the same in any country. If you have large crowds gathering for protests, there are going to be arrests. I mean, even today, there were cases raised with the European Commission of alleged abuses by police in Spain. We've seen it right across the European Union. We've seen it in Belgium here, when protesters get together at a time of a national pandemic or a global pandemic, there are going to be arrests. But the way these details are treated by different media organizations is really striking, to say the least. And, so it's all one way. It's all anti-Russia and the whole thing. We just don't get the full picture whatsoever. And there are a few. They are in the minority. But there are a few EU lawmakers who do highlight that this man that we're talking about, Alexei Navalny, he's certainly no angel. He has a very shady past. He has very questionable support, so there's a lot of a lot of behind the scenes apparently happening in terms of trying to trump up support for him, which is being funded by Western powers and so on. And so this has been highlighted in the European Parliament by a few EU lawmakers. But, you know, I also, by the way, I have some statements here from the EU ambassador to the from the Russian ambassador to the EU, which I can give you, or maybe you want to speak to our other guest first.
Okay, let me just ask him. When you take a look at this, John Ross, I'm guessing that it's not just about Navalny here, that the issue runs deeper when it comes to the EU and Russia. And I believe that what really jump-started all this was the way that the whole Ukraine situation went down. What is the end game that the EU is looking for when it comes to Russia, do you think?
Well, there's a long history of intervention by the EU and the United States inside Russia. I lived in Moscow from 1992 to 2000. And in 1993, the Russian parliament was attacked with tanks. You know, there was heavy machine gun fire, shelling, and many people killed. And this was by President Yeltsin against the Russian parliament. And the United States and the West supported this. It was an extraordinary thing to happen. And then you've had interference over such questions as the questions of Crimea. It's anybody who knows Russian history knows that the Crimea has always been part of Russia. It was only removed from Russia by an absurd decision made by Khrushchev. And if there was any ever referendum inside the Crimea, as there was, it would be won overwhelmingly, which it was. The people of the Crimea don't want to be part of the Ukraine. I mean, it's simple. Like, for 300 years, they're part of Russia. So what you have is therefore an attempt to force the population to live in a country that they don't want to live in by force. That's a pretty drastic intervention into the affairs of a country. So this is only one part of a very, very long record. And as was said, Navalny is not actually the biggest opposition figure in Russia. I mean, the Communist Party is actually by far the biggest opposition organization inside of Russia. But I don't notice the West playing that up. They just seem to play up people who are favorable to the West. So the whole thing is a pattern of interference in internal affairs.
Okay, Jerome Hughes, you wanted to continue maybe perhaps with what you wanted to say before.
Yeah, just briefly, Vladimir Shuzov, who's the Russian ambassador to the EU, he has been making comments, and, you know, he doesn't like to call these sanctions. He likes to, because he says only the United Nations can deliver sanctions. He calls these restrictive measures or whatever. But he says the actions are illogical, strikingly politicized, and taken under far-fetched pretexts. And he says Russia is a reliable and responsible partner and will not slam the door in response to these actions by the European Union. And he says if Russia does respond, the actions will be based on facts and analysis rather than assumptions and emotions. So, you know, Russia's, and we've interviewed Ambassador Shuzov many times, and he always makes the point that there is potential for great relations between Russia and the European Union, but for whatever reason, whoever is sort of cranking the machine in the background, you know, that just never comes about. And so it's just one issue after another, and any opportunity to beat Russia with a stick is taken by the European Union and by the United States.
Final question goes to you, John Ross. We have seen the way that the EU has treated Russia when it comes to respective countries. For example, Germany. We could talk about the Nord Stream 2, or maybe you can, of how that's going down. Also, the way that Josep Borrell actually went to Russia looking for the COVID vaccination by the name of Sputnik 5, of which Ursula von der Leyen has been faulted for not being able to handle the distribution. Are certain countries within the EU okay with Russia, but not the EU itself?
They're relatively divided. As you said, the relations are very complex. If you take Nord Stream 2, this is a pipeline under the Baltic to supply Germany with gas at a much cheaper rate than the liquid gas it would be forced to import from the United States. So the United States have been trying to persuade Germany to instead import liquid gas from the United States at a higher price, because it's in the interest of the United States. This is a pretty drastic interference in the internal affairs of Germany and against its interests. Yeah, there's quite big divisions within the European Union on this. On this particular case, unfortunately, what has happened is they've got together behind a person, Navalny, who's not very reputable, who's not a major opposition figure in side Russia, compared to people who are opposed to the Kremlin. And this will create a lot of problems for them, the European Union inside Russia. Because I lived there for 8 years, I've got many friends in Russia, and they think this is completely disgraceful interference in their internal affairs. So the whole thing is actually completely counterproductive, even from the point of the EU. They should just stay out of the situation.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's John Ross, senior fellow at Chongyang Institute. John, it's a pleasure to see you. Correspondent there from Brussels. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. Yemen's Ansarullah movement and Saudi-backed former government delegations have wrapped up the latest round of prisoner swap talks without reaching any agreement. Head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners Affairs says the failure is due to the continued intransigence of the Saudi-backed delegation. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has also said the failure confirms the party's lack of seriousness toward any solution. The correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
After weeks of negotiating in Amman, the head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners Affairs says the talks have ended without making any progress due to the inflexible approach of the delegation of former government backed by Saudi Arabia. The committee says it has made several proposals to overcome the differences, all in vain.
There are many reasons that caused the failure of the negotiations, including that the other party presented new names that did not exist before and changed the list that was agreed upon. Another reason is that the Islam Party, one of the parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition, wants to free its members only. A third reason is that they don't have one delegation to negotiate, but rather multiple delegations representing different parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition.
A member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, described the Saudi-backed delegation's refusal of swap deals as a crime. He said the failure of talks is a message from Saudi Arabia and its allies that they're not serious about any solution that may end the suffering of the Yemenis. He said their calls for peace are not in line with any real action.
The countries of the coalition of aggression led by the U.S., Saudi Arabia and the UAE are the ones that impede the prisoners' exchange effort for many reasons, including for protecting their interests of controlling Yemen. The parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition are not involved in decision-making process of the swap deals and lacks access to the data of the prisoners, and this is the reason for the great confusion.
More than 15,000 Yemenis were captured in battle fronts by both warring sides since the beginning of the war in March 2015. Of these prisoners, only more than 1,000 were released in 2020 under a UN brokered deal, while hundreds of others have been freed through local negotiations.
The release of thousands of Yemenis from Saudi prisons needs more efforts by the United Nations to pressure the representatives of the former government and the Saudi-led coalition to stop hampering the swaps. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Even as Texas struggled to restore electricity and water over the past week, signs of the risk posed by increasingly extreme weather to America's aging infrastructure were cropping up across the country. The week's continent-spanning winter storms triggered blackouts in Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and several other states. One-third of oil production in the nation was halted. Drinking water systems in Ohio were knocked offline. Road networks nationwide were paralyzed. And vaccination efforts in 20 states were disrupted. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Christopher Flavelle, Brad Plummer, and Hiroku Tabuchi. The piece is titled Texas Blackouts Point to Coast-to-Coast Crises Waiting to Happen. Stay with us for more. Even as Texas struggled to restore electricity and water supplies over the past week, signs of the risk posed by increasingly extreme weather to America's aging infrastructure were cropping up across the country. The week's continent-spanning winter storms triggered blackouts in Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and several other states. One-third of oil production in the nation was halted. Drinking water systems in Ohio were knocked offline. Road networks nationwide were paralyzed. And vaccination efforts in 20 states were disrupted. The crisis carries a profound warning. As climate change brings more frequent and intense storms, floods, heat waves, wildfires, and other extreme events, it is placing growing stress on the foundations of America's economy. Its network of roads and railways, drinking water systems, power plants, electrical grids, industrial waste sites, and even homes. Failures in just one sector can set off a domino effect of breakdowns in hard-to-predict ways. Much of this infrastructure was built decades ago under the expectation that the environment around it would remain stable or at least fluctuate within predictable bounds. Now climate change is upending that assumption. We are colliding with a future of extremes, said Alice Hill, who oversaw planning for climate risks on the National Security Council during the Obama administration. We base all our choices about risk management on what's occurred in the past, and that is no longer a safe guide. While it's not always possible to say precisely how global warming influenced any one particular storm, scientists say an overall rise in extreme weather creates sweeping new risks. Sewer systems are overflowing more often as powerful rainstorms exceed their design capacity. Coastal homes and highways are collapsing as intensified runoff erodes cliffs. Coal ash, the toxic residue produced by coal-burning plants, is spilling into rivers as floods overwhelm barriers meant to hold it back. Homes once beyond the reach of wildfires are burning in blazes they were never designed to withstand. Problems like these often reflect an inclination of governments to spend as little money as possible, said Shalini Vaihala, a former Obama administration official who now advises cities on meeting climate threats. She said it's hard to persuade taxpayers to spend extra money to guard against disasters that seem unlikely. But climate change flips that logic, making inaction far costlier. Shalini Vaihala says, "The argument I would make is we can't afford not to, because we're absorbing the cost." Adding, "After disasters strike, we're spending poorly." The Biden administration has talked extensively about climate change, particularly the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and create jobs in renewable energies. But it has spent less time discussing how to manage the growing effects of climate change, facing criticism from experts for not appointing more people who focus on climate resilience. "I'm extremely concerned by the lack of emergency management expertise reflected in Biden's climate team," says Samantha Montano, an assistant professor at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy who focuses on disaster policy. Samantha Montano added, "There's an urgency here that still is not being reflected." A White House spokesman, Vedant Patel, said in a statement, "Building resilient and sustainable infrastructure that can withstand extreme weather and a changing climate will play an integral role in creating millions of good-paying union jobs, whilst cutting greenhouse gas emissions." And while President Joe Biden has called for a major push to refurbish and upgrade the nation's infrastructure, getting a closely divided Congress to spend hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, will be a major challenge. Heightening the cost to society, disruptions can disproportionately affect lower-income households and other vulnerable groups, including older people, or those with limited English. "All these issues are converging," said Robert Bullard, a professor at Texas Southern University who studies wealth and racial disparities relating to the environment. "And there's simply no place in this country that's not going to have to deal with climate change," Robert Bullard added. In September, when a sudden storm dumped a record of more than 2 inches of water on Washington in less than 75 minutes, the result wasn't just widespread flooding, but also raw sewage rushing into hundreds of homes. Washington, like many other cities in the Northeast and Midwest, relies on what's called a combined sewer overflow system. A downpour overwhelms storm drains along the street. They are built to overflow into the pipes that carry raw sewage. But if there's too much pressure, sewage can be pushed backwards into people's homes, where the forces can send it erupting from toilets and shower drains. This is what happened in Washington. The city's system was built in the late 1800s. Now climate change is straining an already outdated design. Washington, D.C. Water, the local utility, is spending billions of dollars so that the system can hold more sewage. "We're sort of in uncharted territory," said Vincent Morris, a utility spokesman. "The challenge of managing and taming the nation's water supplies, whether in streets and homes or in vast rivers and watersheds, is growing increasingly complex as storms intensify. Last May, rain-swollen flooding breached two dams in central Michigan, forcing thousands of residents to flee their homes and threatening a chemical complex and toxic waste cleanup site. Experts warned it was unlikely to be the last such failure. many of the country's 90,000 dams were built decades ago and were already in dire need of repairs. Now, climate change poses an additional threat, bringing heavier downpours to parts of the country and raising the odds that some dams could be overwhelmed by more water than they were designed to handle. One recent study found that most of California's biggest dams were at increased risk of failure as global warming advances. In recent years, dam safety officials have begun grappling with the dangers. Colorado, for instance, now requires dam builders to take into account the risk of increased atmospheric moisture driven by climate change as they plan for worst-case flooding scenarios. But nationwide, there remains a backlog of thousands of older dams that still need to be rehabilitated or upgraded. The price tag could ultimately stretch to more than $70 billion. Whenever we study dam failures, we often find there was a lot of complacency beforehand, according to Bill McCormick, president of the Association of State Dam Safety Officials. But given that failures can have catastrophic consequences, we really can't afford to be complacent. If the Texas blackouts exposed one state's poor planning, they also provide a warning for the nation. Climate change threatens virtually every aspect of electricity grids that aren't always designed to handle increasingly severe weather. The vulnerabilities show up in power lines, in natural gas plants, in nuclear reactors, and myriad other systems. Higher storm surges can knock out coastal power infrastructure. Deeper droughts can reduce water supplies for hydroelectric dams. Severe heat waves can reduce the efficiency of fossil fuel generators. Transmission lines and even solar panels at precisely the moment that demand soars because everyone cranks up their air conditioning. Climate hazards can also combine in new and unforeseen ways. In California, for example, Pacific Gas and Electric has had to shut off electricity to thousands of people during exceptionally dangerous wildfire seasons. The reason? Downed power lines can spark huge wildfires in dry vegetation. Then, during a record-hot August last year, several of the state's natural gas plants malfunctioned in the heat, just as demand was spiking, contributing to blackouts. We have to get better at understanding these compound impacts, said Michael Craig, an expert in energy systems at the University of Michigan, who recently led a study looking at how rising summer temperatures in Texas could strain the national grid in unexpected ways. It's an incredibly complex problem to plan for. Some utilities are taking notice. After Superstorm Sandy in 2012, knocked out power lines for 8.7 million customers, utilities in New York and New Jersey invested billions of dollars in flood walls, submersible equipment, and other technology to reduce the risk of failures. Last month, New York's Con Edison said it would incorporate climate projections into its planning. As freezing temperatures struck Texas this week, a glitch at one of two reactors at a South Texas nuclear plant, which serves 2 million homes, triggered a shutdown of the system. The cause? Sensing lines connected to the plant's water pumps had frozen, according to Victor Drix, a spokesman for the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Agency, NRA. It's also common for extreme heat to disrupt nuclear power. The issue is that the water used to cool reactors can become too warm to use, forcing shutdowns. Flooding is another risk. After a tsunami led to several meltdowns at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi power plant in 2011, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, told the 60 or so working nuclear plants in the United States, many decades old, to evaluate their flood risk to account for climate change. 90% showed at least one type of flood risk that exceeded what the plant was designed to handle. The greatest risk came from heavy rain and snowfall exceeding the design parameters at 53 nuclear plants. Scott Burnell, a Nuclear Regulatory Commission NRC spokesman, said in a statement, the NRC continues to conclude, based on the staff's review of detailed analyses, that all U.S. nuclear power plants can appropriately deal with potential flooding events, including the effects of climate change, and remain safe.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Reports are emerging from ICE detention centers of solitary confinement cells with no heat and guards blasting fans at detainees complaining of cold, says Aline Brown, reporter, in an article published under the heading "Dying of Cold, ICE Detainees Freezing in Southern Prisons." Stay tuned, please. In Louisiana and Texas, immigrants seeking asylum are facing dire conditions in U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention centers, hit recently by extreme cold. At the South Texas Family Residential Center in Dilley, Texas, advocates say parents and children have been living with overflowing toilets, thirst, poor hygiene, and heat that fades in and out. 20 miles away at the South Texas ICE Processing Center in Pearsall, advocates say detainees who complain about the cold faced retaliation. At the Pine Prairie ICE Processing Center in Louisiana, a detainee interviewed by The Intercept reports that the segregation unit, akin to solitary confinement, has no heat. Lucia Allen, communications manager for the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, known as RACES, has been in contact with Obaldo Oca Lopez, a father detained at the Pure Soul facility located outside San Antonio. Although the ICE Processing Center, which is run by the private prison firm GEO Group, did not lose power, detainees were still left without sufficient heat. He said, "We are all really, really cold," Alan told The Intercept of her conversation with Oca Lopez. Detainees' complaints to ICE agents about the temperature have been met with retaliation, Oca Lopez told Allen. "The officers are turning on fans to make it colder," Allen said. "If they are hearing complaints like, 'Oh, it's cold in here,' they will be like, 'It could be worse,' and turn on fans." Oca Lopez told her that agents have thrown blankets into garbage after detainees' complaint. "The situation heightened fears that the cold will leave people vulnerable to COVID-19 in a unit that houses around 90 people. ICE detention centers have been racked with coronavirus infections, in part thanks to the nature of the close quarters. Detainees, advocates, and whistleblowers have also reported mismanagement and medical neglect." Oca Lopez told Allen that the tension has at times spilled over into detainees fighting over the insufficient blankets. ICE officials deny there is a problem with heat at the Pure Soul facility. Temperature checks at Pure Soul showed that all areas of the facility were on average 70 degrees and within the acceptable range of 69 to 76 degrees, a spokesperson told The Intercept over email. Immigration advocates are accustomed to ICE denying problems exist. "First, we had the mistreatment and separation of families. Then we came into COVID with people getting sick in these facilities. Now we have this whole other situation happening," said Allen. She noted that many of the detainees in these centers could be paroled into U.S. as they awaited asylum and other immigration rulings. So far, the Biden administration has failed to take action. In Texas, there is no move from this administration to release these families. ICE's Pine Prairie, Louisiana Detention Center, the system of punishment for detainees became much more severe with the cold. Angel Argueta Anariba, who is detained there, told The Intercept that although other parts of the facility have heat, the segregation unit does not. Argueta Anariba was placed in an individual segregation cell a few days before the cold set in, a situation he describes as retaliatory. Argueta Anariba has a health condition that calls for special diet. For months, he has pressured the various ICE facilities to which he has been transferred to fulfill his dietary requirements, to no avail. He said the Pine Prairie administration's explanation for placing him in segregation, that he destroyed government property, is completely false. Rather, he believes it was retaliation for the continued pressure he has put on the institution to give him the correct meals. Pine Prairie was recently accused of other retaliatory efforts. The Intercept reported recently that a guard at the private prison had threatened detainees with being put into coronavirus ward if they did not submit to deportation orders. For Argueta Anariba, the typical stresses of isolated confinement were unexpectedly compounded by the cold. Although detainees in segregation are in individual cells, Argueta Anariba was able to speak to the others through the walls. "There is no heat, there is nothing. We were eight people dying of cold," he said. Argueta Anariba said he put on three pairs of pants and three shirts and stayed wrapped in his sheets in his bed all the day. He said that meals would arrive cold by the time they got to the cell. His bones ached. "I'm asthmatic," he said. "On Sunday, I had terrible chest pain. Though the freezing weather arrived on Friday," Argueta Anariba said, "it wasn't until Sunday that he was offered an extra blanket." Recently, he was released back into a regular heated unit, a move, he says, could have happened sooner to protect him from the cold. IC officials told The Intercept that although Pine Prairie made use of a generator on Wednesday, and the facility never lost heat or power, IC facilities in Louisiana are experiencing weather-related impacts that mirror the local community. However, all IC facilities have backup generator power, a spokesperson said. All facilities have also implemented contingency plans developed in anticipation of severe winter weather. The assessment did not match Argueta Anariba experience. "There are seven people still in those conditions. To leave people in those conditions is inhumane." Families freeze in Texas. IC has the power to allow detainees to leave facilities that have become increasingly dangerous, said Natalie Lerner, a paralegal with Proyecto Dili, a pro bono legal services provider for detainees at the South Texas Family Residential Center. "In our view, they should pretty seriously consider releasing everybody," she said. "It seems like the conditions aren't very safe. The pandemic is of particular concern. What has been on my mind is the folks we work with that have pre-existing issues who are already vulnerable because of COVID-19, and this is further threatening their health," she said. Families she works with inside the South Texas Family Residential Center, which is managed by private prison company Core Civic, report that since Sunday, the heat and electricity have periodically shut down at times for long stretches. Over the weekend, the water was cut off and toilets overflowed. "With no means to flush, the shared toilets became more and more full," Lerner said. "Parents and children were given one bottle of water in the morning to get them through the day. They were left wearing the same clothes for days on end. As of Thursday, blackouts and problems with water continued. With phone services spotty, a sense of isolation has set in. One client I have been working with who has a wife in the facility, they are detained separately. She has a lot of medical concerns," Lerner said. "He has been really, really worried about her." She added that there is a huge amount of worry for parents for their kids. "We have heard people saying kids are getting sick because of how cold it is," she said. People are expressing a lot of desperation. Again, IC officials denied the Advocate's reports. Like most of Texas, IC facilities in Texas have had to deal with intermittent power outages and interruptions in water service. However, all IC facilities have backup generator power, a spokesperson said. Toilets at South Texas FRC are not overflowing. Residents of the South Texas FRC did experience interruptions in water service for a couple of days, like most of Texas, but it was restored recently. No facilities are rationing water bottles, and they have plenty of water bottles. across the border in Matamoros, asylum seekers, including families with children, have suffered the cold weather at a refugee camp that emerged in response to President Donald Trump's anti-immigration policies. The Migration Protection Protocols, known as the Remain in Mexico policy, forced many asylum seekers to wait for their asylum hearings on the Mexico side of the border. Although President Joe Biden ended the program, the asylum seekers have not yet been processed. Although the extreme weather is certainly to blame for much of the misery in IC detention centers this month, many of the conditions precede the storms. Even in areas accustomed to cold, the immigration agency's detention centers have a reputation for failing to keep people warm in cold weather.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The result of the U.S.'s presence in our country was economic and scientific poverty, corruption, and cultural decadence. They created such a condition in our country. Now, some people think that if we interact, make up, and become good friends with the U.S., the country will become something of a paradise. No, that will not be the case, and you only need to look at the pre-revolutionary era to see what things were like back then. Look at those countries. which exchange loving words with the U.S. to see in what condition they are. You can clearly see their economic and scientific condition. There are some countries in our own region, but I do not want to mention their names. You yourselves know which countries I'm speaking about. Of course, even after the victory of our great revolution, the U.S. did not stop its plots. The U.S. is after achieving the same hellish domination over our country. Not only our country, but also the whole region.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Some people ask, what is the difference between the US and such a European country? The difference lies in this fact. Because the US used to ensure its interest for many years in Iran, because it had built itself a nice home here, and because it considers itself to be the superior power, it wants to restore the previous conditions. This is what makes the Iranian nation vigilant and careful. Of course, some treacherous countries in the region are helping it as well. I wish to add that in the current circumstances, the US finds its interest in creating instability in the region until it manages to achieve complete domination over the region. Until then, it finds its interest in creating instability in the region. This is being acknowledged explicitly by themselves. A well-known expert in a famous American organization, the American Enterprise Institute, if I mention his name, those who are interested in political work will organize him easily, said this openly. He said that they are not after creating stability in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. He does not just mention Iran. Rather, he mentions Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, saying that they are not interested in stability in those countries.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.